Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I want to first welcome you, and on behalf of the Tattered Cover, thank you for your support of our locally owned bookstore. We very much appreciate you being here tonight. So you all know who's here tonight. I'm not going to spend too much time introducing him. He's the founder of Cooks Illustrated, the star and creator of America's Test Kitchen, and his new book is really cool. It's called Fanny's Last Supper. So please join me in welcoming Chris Kimball.
If you've seen me here, first of all, this is my favorite bookstore in the world, so, I mean, and indies are doing better now, so that's great, so thanks for coming. I don't usually sell books when I come. I ignore the fact that we just published a book and everybody in my office gets mad at me. They ask me why they send me out on the road if I don't sell books. So I'm going to take 120 seconds to sell you my book, then we can have fun. So you just have to put up with a brief introduction. The book is Fanny's Last Supper. I've been working on it for 3 years now. And the notion was, it started in the early 80s. I bought a house in Connecticut, and there was one book in the house at the time in the library. It was Mary Lincoln's 1890 version, edition of the Boston Cooking School Cookbook. And then I moved to Boston, and Vermont, but in Boston in the early 90s, and it turns out I was living five blocks away from where Fanny Farmer lived in the 1890s. And so I got interested in Fanny, got interested in Mary Lincoln, and I started researching her school, which was up on the Boston Common, and interested in her. And I finally got the notion of, look, it's kind of hard to look at recipes in old cookbooks. I do that all the time. I have a large collection. And you can't just look at the recipes. You have to go cook them. But the problem is you can't cook them because you don't have the right ingredients, you don't have a coal-fired stove, and a few other minor problems. And they didn't have food processors, standing mixtures. And, you know, and they didn't have, you know, frozen cheese puffs and other stuff. So I decided to do the whole thing. So I found an old coal stove in a club in Boston called the St. Botolph Club, which is an arts club, and I conned them out of their stove, which was in the basement. I had it reassembled in our house. I converted it to wood because we were going to grill some salmon on it as one of the courses. And coal stinks and makes a mess. But we did that, and I started researching the recipes and researching what it was like to be a cook in 1890s Boston and what it was like to go shopping in Boston at the time, which is better than shopping in Boston today, it turns out. Much better. And you know, where they got their ingredients from and what the ingredients were. So I put together a 12-course menu that was based on a menu in the back of the original 1896 Fanny Farmer Boston Cooking School cookbook. I did vary it over time. We tested the recipe. Some of her food was great. Some of her food was absolutely inedible. She was very good at roasts and puddings and that sort of thing. Fish, no. You know, fish was like cooked for 45 minutes, you know. And delicate sauces, no. You know, put a half a cup of flour in it. This was not a scoffier here. But some of the food was quite interesting. So we started cooking the food. And I got my test kitchen director, Erin McMurr, on board, who's a much better cook than I am. She's actually cooked in a restaurant for years. And so I was her sous chef. I started out as a sous chef. I got demoted over time. I mean, I remember one day I had to do a brunoise for a soup as a garnish, and which is a very, very small dice. And I was very proud. I did leeks and carrots, and I took my time, and I thought it was perfect. And she looked at it and said, "That's very nice," and then she threw them out, and then she did them. So, so it was a real comeuppance for me. So I was her assistant during this time, and we cooked every Saturday for the better part of 2 years to try the recipes, and we finally figured it out and gave a big dinner last November. We invited a bunch of people over and cooked 12 courses in 3 hours and cooked it on a on a wood, well, converted coal cook stove. We didn't use conventional ovens. I don't even think we used a food processor or mixer. I think everything was cooked on the stove. What was interesting was we actually got to love cooking on the stove because these big cast iron stoves have an infinite variety of heat. You know, put something on the back burner meant put on the back burner. That's the cooler part of the stove. The front center is hot. The sides are medium. So you could actually have a variety of heats instantly. It's actually better than a modern stovetop if you have 2 hours to get it heated up in the morning. But besides that, and the ovens actually give you more radiant heat, so when we were roasting some of the meat, like the venison, which was larded, it would melt the lard. And so we actually enjoyed doing this. So that the book is the story of that. But it's really a mystery book. It's a mystery book because I wanted to go find out where American cooking came from and why. You know, today we have this schizophrenic food world where there's a lot of great cooks out there and a lot of other people are eating a lot of fast food. It's this strange mixture. In Fanny's time, in the Victorian time, it was the same thing. It was a mix of complete opposites. You know, before the Civil War, cooking in America was really about preservation. Because you get a whole pig, you get 10 bushels of beans, you get something else. You had to preserve the food. So almost all of the cooking that was done up until that time was about preservation. Salting, brining, smoking, etc. After the Civil War, the railroads were built out. Commercial refrigeration came in the 1880s. People got salmon from Oregon. They got fruits from California and Florida. They get mushrooms from Paris. They get Parmesan from Italy. All of a sudden, the world opened up. So by Fanny's time, there was a retailer in Boston called S.S. Pierce that had over 4,000 items for sale. And you could get everything. If you were wealthy, of course. America was really divided into people who were still cooking like it was 1800, because they were farmers, they were on the farm, and there were people in the cities who had money because of the Industrial Revolution, like Fanny and her and the people in Boston, who could afford the most expensive ingredients. So that's how that got started. And then the Victorians were spending 7 hours a day cooking and cleaning, not including childcare, by the way. That's just cooking and cleaning. So when Jell-O came around about 1890, they were going, yeah, I like this. Right now, I mean, you know, in this book, I'll go through the menu in a second, we actually made Victorian jellies, which are just absolutely phenomenal. They were the best thing we did. And we started by boiling calf's feet to make gelatin, which actually works, and it's not hard to do. It doesn't smell. It's fine. And then you mix it with sugar and some lemon juice, and you sort of have a base. Well, that's how they would make gelatin. As time went on, they figured out that they could take the swim bladders of fish, like sturgeon, and dry it and shred it. It was called isinglass, and that was because this looks like shredded wheat. And they would use that as a thickener. And then they used Irish moss, which is made of seaweed off the west coast of Ireland, also off Massachusetts. They used that as a thickener. And finally, Knox gelatin came around in the 1880s. So that by Fanny's time, they could use powdered gelatin. But at that time, you'd find people doing each of those things because America was a mix of all sorts of people. So that's how they made their gelatin. So when Jell-O came around and it had the colors and had the flavors and everything else, you know, the Victorians were really thrilled to not have to spend a lot of time cooking. Women at the time, there was a huge movement to get rid of cooking, to have it done communally. Women in particular wanted to have a much more interesting life in terms of, you know, their creativity. That's why the home became this huge place of decoration and creativity, because women wanted, that was something they could do. But they used to cook all day and take care of things up until the Civil War. Now there was money, there was time. Cooking was something that they could do as a creative art. And that's why the Victorians, who were so straight-laced, when they got to the kitchen, they went nuts because they made these ridiculous things. For example, one of the jellies was a rhubarb jelly, and they make jellies, you know, jellies within jellies, and in the center they put a strawberry Bavarian. So that was one of our jellies. They would make, we made a multi-layer jelly and they with homemade food colorings, cream for white, spinach for green, saffron for yellow, and beets for red, and you make your homemade colorings. We did one which was a Spätlese sweet dessert wine with a spiral of cubed pork jelly. And you have to tilt the mold and let it sit and put another layer on it. It just takes forever. We did a mandarin cake, which took 10 hours to prepare, which was based on a French Savoy cake. At the time, they used to bake cakes in molds. They'd hollow them out, fill them with pastry cream. They'd create a base, put a marzipan layer on it. Then, that was the beginning, then you take tangerines and you'd cut them in half, hollow them out, and fill them with an orange sorbet. And then underneath, as a decoration, you take more tangerines, clementines, you'd hollow them out but leave them intact and put alternating layers of almond and clementine jelly. And then cut them in quarters. And then you have to decorate it, et cetera. So, you know, they were nuts. They had a lot of time and they had fun. Fanny was really an interesting person. She was born in 1857 in Medford outside of Boston. She had polio when she was 12. She couldn't go to college as a result. Her sisters did. She became a mother's helper at the time and for Mrs. Shaw in Cambridge. And then she, in the late 80s, joined the Boston Cooking School, where Mary Lincoln had been the proprietor for many years. A few years later, she was asked to take over, 1892 or 3, and she ran the school. 1896, she decided to redo the Boston Cooking School cookbook. Mary Lincoln had done the first edition. Fanny had a lot of revisions, to be fair to her, but she went to Little Brown. She used to be my publisher years ago, and they were just as smart now as they were then. They decided that they weren't going to put up the money. Fanny would have to put up the money. She put up $3,000. At that time, the annual salary was around $500 or $600. It was a lot of money. She put up the money. They published the book, and she retained the copyright. And at the time, the best-selling book was Ben-Hur. She was like the number two book on the best New York Times bestseller list for years. She sold almost 400,000 copies by the time she died at the beginning of the First World War, which was a huge number of copies. 4 million copies have been sold today. So she made a fortune because she retained the copyright. Little Brown, you know, didn't. She ended up with her estate was about $250,000 when she died, which was in that time, you know, quite a lot of money. So she was very successful. She was known as a businesswoman, first and foremost, when she was asked what she was. She was the first lecturer at Harvard, a woman lecturer at Harvard. She believed, at the time, the Boston Cooking School was created to help the poor people who were devoted to gin and other things. The gin cup, as they put it, which was a big problem. By the way, I was in London this summer, and I got a tour of London, and the guy said at the time, 1880s and 90s, even in London, about 30% of the population was just stone drunk by 8 in the morning, because gin was very cheap. And so everyone was drinking gin in Boston and London, and this was a huge problem. So the Boston Cooking School was started to help people at home for very little money, learn to cook for themselves. Well, Fanny figured out the money was in all the rich people up in Beacon Hill. So she did that too, but she started teaching people who had money, who wanted the latest foods from Delmonico's in New York, from Paris. So she would put puff pastry and everything and pour white sauce on it and call it a la reine, you know, which was sort of like, it's okay, this is it. So she was very smart. So the school was very successful. She left in 1902, started her own school, the Boston Cooking School, you know, floundered a few months later and closed. And she went on to great success. So she was a businesswoman. She was a good cook. She was a great lecturer. She had a great personality. She was an excellent cookbook writer and recipe writer. She really was the first person to modernize recipes, which was happening in the late 19th century. As we learned about her cooking, it was really an adventure. Let me give you an example. Mock turtle soup. Turtle soup was a huge hit in the 19th century, both in England and here. And by the end of the 1800s, the diamondback terrapin out of Chesapeake, which is what they used, was becoming very expensive. So the British, among others, love mock foods. That is, you make something out of something else, which is cheaper. So they figured out, some poor guy or woman figured out that if you boiled a calf's head, let's be patient. it actually is delicious. We just made a miniature version of this dinner last week. It was great. It tastes like turtle. And I know because I made turtle soup. I called the Maryland Department of Fisheries about 2 years ago. I said, I'd love to come down and fish for terrapin because I thought that would be part of the story. And, you know, I got this horrible email back about how you know, like clubbing baby seals, you know. So... And so I said, how long has this ban been in effect? Like 3 months, you know. It's always the last sinner in church. So they were very righteous. So I did find there is legal turtle meat you can buy, which I did, and made a bunch of soups from a bunch of New Orleans restaurants. And it was good, not great. But then we found mock turtle soup. Well, the first thing I did was find a calf's head. You know, you ever gone into your butcher and asked for a calf's head? I mean, it's sort of like you're asking for something that's a black market. We found a guy, and we went in. There was a huge box like this. We'd ordered two calves heads, and it was like, you know, bloody at the bottom. It was pretty awful. Well, they gave us 10. I don't know. This guy's like, you know, cornered the market on calves head. We brought him back. I said, well, okay, let's boil the head. So, because it says, you know, boil head. So in those days, recipes, before Fanny's time in the 1880s or 1870s, they're very short. They'd say, make a paste when they meant make pie pastry. Well, today, it would take 500 words to describe how to make pie pastry. So they said, you know, boil calf's head, which I did, and we made the stock, and then you make a soup. Well, to say the least, it was a little thick and goopy and not very attractive. Well, I'd done something wrong. And this is sort of the story of the book, is trying to figure out what they meant when they wrote recipes. I found a recipe from a New York cooking school, actually, in the 1880s. And it said, first, remove brains. Aha! Great. I forgot that. Well, see, this is what everybody else knew at Fanny's time, was you take the brains out first, you idiot. You know, so, and the eyes, you know, I won't go into that. But and they have to split the head up and clean it and soak it. So we figured that out finally. And then we made a stock, and then we made a soup, and we used the shredded face meat, and it sounds disgusting, but it was actually really good. And then I was looking for a garnish. Well, I found in a book from the 1870s that suggested you make brain balls. Well, I mean, I figured, look, I was in for a penny, so I was already boiling calves' heads. So I took the brain out, and I poached the brain in a court bouillon for 20 minutes, and you have to, it says in all the recipes, be careful, be very gentle handling brains because they turn to custard. Well, they do, actually. I know that because it's happened to me a number of times. So you have to be very gentle with them, and then you add breadcrumbs and egg, and you make brain balls and cover them with more breadcrumbs, and you fry them on top of the stove, and they're actually quite good. I did have a dilemma, however, when all these muckety-mucks sat down for dinner, whether I should tell them before or after. I decided to tell them after. And I it was fun, yes. I think Harry Smith from CBS almost threw up, but he was game. So that was, the first course was oysters. Everyone always served oysters, mock turtle soup. Then we did a dish called, rissole are puff pastry that are stuffed and fried. They've been around since Roman times in different guises. We made our own puff pastry in a very hot oven, a very hot kitchen, which was difficult to do, but we did. Those were quite good. We did lobster l'Americaine, which is a very famous dish. Fanny's version was actually pretty good. We updated it. We did a saddle of venison. We finally found the right size venison, an 8-pound saddle, and we larded it, which means taking salt pork and sewing it through the outside of it. And again, we found that it was very important to have a very hot oven. The oven got so hot for that course, we had to get up to about 600 degrees. So Keith, who was our sous chef, kept stuffing the wood in, you know. So this is an old 1859 house with lathe and plaster. So he got it up to 850 degrees. And we put the thermometer in, and the dial, it just kept going around, you know. So it was 95. We had a small air conditioner, which didn't do anything. On top of the air conditioner, it was 93. And so it was about 120 or 30 right by the stove. It was so hot, people would have to stand like this, you know, and with long spoons and fry the rissole because you couldn't get too close. In fact, Aaron's pants, I think, were polyester and melted. And we actually covered her legs with aluminum foil. While she was cooking, so that was a good course. We did fried baby artichokes, which was a specialty back then, which is still quite good. We did a Canton punch, which is a ginger punch, which is one of her better recipes, sorbet. And then we did a roast goose, where we cooked the legs and the breast separately in different methods, and with a chestnut stuffing. And then we moved on to the jellies I've talked about and the mandarin cake. So those are the 12 courses. So the book is the story about that meal and about the Victorians and what we learned. You know, the only thing that was really interesting to me was that the food scene back then is identical to the way it is today. It's really the same. It's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. There's no consistent American cooking. It was all over the place because of immigration, people living in different places, the rich, the poor, and everyone in between. So it was really, it felt very modern to me. I mean, the Victorians lived in a time of greater change than today. Because you think about pre-Civil War of 1900, the country had gone from totally agrarian to very industrial. It completely changed. The very rich, though, did have great parties. Stanford White, the architect in New York, had a very famous party around the First World War where he invited his male friends. And there was a large pie at the end of the dinner where a naked girl jumped out of the pie and ran upstairs, which was commented much in the New York Daily News at the time. There was a very famous party in Newport where they feted a chimpanzee who wore a tuxedo and smoked a cigar. There was a famous horseback dinner in New York around 1906 where the gentlemen actually rode their horses to the restaurant on the Upper East Side and ate on horseback. Talk about, you know, it's time for the next revolution. And then there was also, there was one other one. Oh, yeah, there was one of the Roosevelts, it was somehow related to Teddy. His son had been given a baby lion while at school, prep school in Connecticut. It started chasing the students and attacking them, so they decided to bring it down to one of the arts clubs in New York. They were feeding a tenderloin steak three times a day, which got rather expensive, so they decided to eat it. So They killed it and roasted it, and had a very. It was the roast lion dinner. Was a very famous dinner around 1906 in New York. So, it was a very interesting time. So, that's the story of the book. I'm going to show you when we're finished just a little bit of the special. We've done a public television special that'll air this fall about the making of the dinner and the history of Fanny Farmer and the cooking. I'd also be happy to sign any other books when I'm done. But before we do that, my favorite part of the evening is take questions. So, yeah.
Once you had decided on the recipes, did you do a full practice?
Oh, yeah, we did. We must have cooked these recipes 20 to 30 times over a period of 18 months. And then we did have a rehearsal dinner 2 weeks before, which was actually more fun than the real dinner because we had no idea what was going to happen. And we also didn't have a film crew there, which made it more fun. So that was actually a funner dinner than the real one. But it did go off fine. I mean, so much of it can be made ahead of time, of course, the stocks and the jellies and everything else. But there's still a lot of last-minute cooking. You got to hold the food, and you have a limited amount of space. And you also had the upstairs-downstairs thing. We had a friend of Aaron's used to work as sous chef at Hammersley's Bistro in Boston, and he was also a waiter. He became the head waiter. He brought in his wife and some friends. They dressed up in Victorian clothes. And, you know, there was the kitchens in these Victorian homes were always downstairs in the back. The dining room was above. And so they would have to plate all the courses, and they'd have to go upstairs. Later, I was told that the women had long skirts on. They'd have to hike their skirts up because they couldn't get up the stairs. So it was very un-Victorian of them. But it was the actual service of the food that was hard. In Victorian times, they didn't want to spend more than 2 hours at the table. And I can't imagine doing 12 courses in 2 hours, so we cheated on that a little bit. But they had very strict rules about how you eat. You could never talk about politics, as that was disturbing to the stomach. Well, it still is. I mean, although I don't mind disturbing the stomach. And this whole thing about the Victorians hated the fact that we were actually animals, you know, so they didn't want to see tooth marks on food, so you'd never bite into an apple because you could see the teeth marks. You're always supposed to leave food on your plate because you shouldn't be too hungry, because that shows you were, you know, too base. And if anything happened, like you spilled wine or whatever, everyone had to ignore it like it didn't happen. So there were very strict rules of behavior, and that's probably why when they got to the kitchen they went crazy and did stupid things. Yeah.
What did you use for refrigeration?
We cheated. We used an old-fashioned Frigidaire from the 1920s that we had restored, and so we did use that. In Fanny's time, they would have had an ice box. Although ice boxes by the 1890s, the upper middle class had them, the rich had them. I'm not sure that everybody had them. I think they were still not ubiquitous at the time, but their boxes obviously had a huge thing of ice in them, and they work fine, and they actually used them for making ice cream and other things, so they were fine as long as you had to drain them, of course, as the ice melted, and the guy would deliver ice every couple of days, so it was similar to our current refrigerators. By the way, has anybody noticed that I have this old ice box with the four doors, have you ever noticed that it's a much better design, because you actually get its stuff? Have you ever noticed that? I mean, whoever invented the modern refrigerator ought to be sent away somewhere. Yeah. That's just my opinion. Yeah.
Did you talk to any of Fanny's family or friends when you were going?
I did talk to a gentleman whose grandmother actually attended Fanny's classes in 1913. She was in school, and she and I have her diary. And her comment was, when Fanny died, after she died, there was no remorse or anything. She just said, "I didn't get to finish my candy-making class." So I don't know if they're very sympathetic people or not. So I went to the archives in Boston, and we actually got hold of the what she used to hand out in the classes when you were doing recipes, and we actually had them, and they were all notated. So when she went through the course, she'd add and change things to the recipes. So she was very organized, and in the last year of her life, she was actually teaching from a wheelchair. And the reports of what she was like from firsthand accounts at the time was she was incredibly energetic and persuasive and just a wonderful teacher. So, yep.
There were 12 courses. Did you have information as to how large the servings have been back at the
term? That's an excellent question. The question was, do we have information about how large the servings had been? I think they were a lot bigger than ours Don't forget, people consumed a lot more food, more calories back then, because they actually walked places. They didn't have cars, and a lot of people were doing a lot of physical labor. So the calorie was probably 4,500 calories a day, something like that. I think today it's 2,500 or 2,700. So they could consume a lot more food. So when we did the portions, we did very small portions. And actually, at the end of the meal, I can't say I wasn't full, but I wasn't stuffed. Of course, it took 3.5 hours to eat it. I could almost go into the next meal. So they would eat a lot. I mean, what they did was for breakfast, they would have a full breakfast, usually with meat of some kind. They didn't make a lot of pancakes and that sort of thing. They would actually have a fairly serious, savory breakfast. Lunch was the biggest meal of the day, as it still is in parts of Europe, when they'd sit down and have a major meal. And then supper usually was cold. It was leftovers. It was simple things, fruit, stewed fruit. They wouldn't have a lot to eat. But I think they consumed a lot more food because they burned off a lot more. Yep.
I wanted to ask you, in my experience, is that a successful dinner party is, in good part, the food that's served, and the other successful component of what makes it successful is the guest. So how did you come up with your guest?
Well, I invited Martha Stewart. She said no, which may have been a good thing. I don't know. Well, I've known her for a long time because I lived near her in Westport, Connecticut for years. And I also visit her in jail, which is a long story. Which is why she won't talk to me anymore. I saw her at her worst moment, I think. Now, I have to say, we did visit her in West Virginia. And she was great. I mean, she was really upbeat and... I was really impressed. I mean, she's incredibly smart, and she actually knows, unlike some people on cooking shows these days, she actually really knows what she's talking about. You could talk to her about anything, like how to build a post barn. Well, she knows everything about it. She actually knows. So I have a great respect for her because she is really an expert on what she does. So anyway, she didn't come. Check that off. I tried a few famous actors and actresses, and I actually we almost got what's her name who did Shakespeare in Love. Gwyneth Paltrow is a huge foodie. She did that Spain thing with a friend of mine, Mark Bittman. And through Mark, I got hold of her. And she actually corresponded and was very interested. And her kids were in school in London at the time, so she couldn't come. But the people who did come, Harry Smith from CBS Early Show, because I do that frequently. Rene Montaigne from Morning Edition, because I do that frequently. Mark Bittman was there. Jose Andres was there, who's... If you ever want to have a successful dinner party, the question was, the guest list is as important as the food, which I agree with. Jose's insane, and he's the nicest guy in the world. But if you want to have a great dinner party, invite Jose. Jose, there was a ice sculpture of a mermaid, naked mermaid, of course, and life size, and that's where the oysters were served in the base, right? Well, Jose decided he'd fall in love with a mermaid. So at the end of the evening, around 1 in the morning, the mermaid was being taken out and thrown unceremoniously into the park. And he demanded that the mermaid be brought up to his room immediately. So that's Jose Andres. He's insane. And we had a few local people from Boston who were quite entertaining, including a couple chefs and a few other people. But it was a really good crowd. And you're right. My best dinner party ever was a famous author who's written a lot about American history. And I put him next to the most liberal person I know, who's pretty, who's just right completely out there. Well, she went on and on about Bush and this and that. The other thing was many years ago. And he turned to her and said, I am a close personal friend of the Bush family. It's a great party. Her face just... I know, it didn't slow her down. She kept going about Bush, but, it was all right. So I'm happy to sign books.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.